Affairs Report, 30 minutes of conversation designed to make you better aware of the world around you. The World Affairs Report is brought to you by the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh in cooperation with KQV News Radio. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that has been bringing the world to Pittsburgh for over 80 years. To learn more about the council and upcoming events, please visit worldpittsburgh.org. And now, the World Affairs Report.
Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Angélica Ocampo, and today it's my pleasure to welcome Professor Carmelo Mesa Lago, who's a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Pittsburgh, where he also taught Latin American studies. He has authored dozens of books and almost 200 articles across dozens of countries and seven languages. He is the former president of Latin American Studies Association and is involved in the editorial board of six academic journals. He studied law at the University of Havana and authored numerous works about Cuban politics, economics, and culture, including his most recent book, Voces de Cambio en el Sector No Estatal Cubano, Voices of Change in the Non-State Cuban Sector. Professor Mesa Lago, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. I have a long relationship and very productive one with the council.
I know, and we are very grateful for that. And it's also interesting to share with the audience, you're a Pittsburgher. You've been here for 50 years.
50 right? years, just this month.
You've lived here a longer time than in Cuba.
Oh, yeah. I am 83 now, so I was 33 years there, and 50 years here.
That's amazing. So a Pittsburgher now.
A Pittsburgher, yeah.
Through and through.
Well, I don't know if I have the Pittsburgh accent.
So let's start by the beginning on the U.S.-Cuba relations. As we all know, since the 60s, the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba came to a halting stop with no diplomatic relationships and an embargo that was imposed that lasted for 55 years
yes.
until the Obama administration started to reinstate diplomatic relationships and lessen the pressure on the economic embargo, which brought some winds of hope to the island, but were reversed with the new Trump administration and their sense that diplomatic relations probably will be stopped, or at least there's going to be some ban on the travels and some ban on investments. What's your take on how the U.S. relationships stand right now?
Well, before that, I think we have to mention the Obama new policy. Basically, the embargo didn't work. The purpose of the embargo was to defeat the Cuban government, to finish the Castro's regime, and 55 years and didn't get it. In fact, for the first time in 1965 in Miami, I was the first Cuban American that criticized the embargo, and one of the reasons that I gave is that the embargo is showing the United States like a big giant of the North that is defeated by the small David. And that was used as a scapegoat by the Cuban government to justify all the many economic errors that they have practicing the island for
errors and abuses,
60 years,
right?
For almost 60 years. And also it's used to justify repression and
right.
Authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a good measure.
It was about time to try a different strategy.
Right. So let's try social, see if it works. I think that Obama took a series of steps. He took out Cuba out of the list of countries which sponsored terrorism. The diplomatic relations were reestablished. The embassy in Havana that had been closed for so many years was opened again. There were 12 categories in which you could travel to Cuba. There were many, many things, and the last one is perhaps the most controversial one, was that they stopped the so-called policy of wet and dry feet that allow Cubans, if they arrive in the United States and they touch ground, then they immediately will receive a special category of refugees. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the Cuban government reacted really not very positively to all these steps. I should say that Obama make a great impression in Cuba because he's an Afro-American in a country in which maybe half of the population is either black or mulatto. And they saw the president, Michelle, his wife, and their two daughters walking in the streets of Havana, going to a small restaurants operated by the private sector, appearing in the most popular comedy in television, saying a few things in Spanish. So they question themselves. We have been taught for 59 years that Americans discriminate, and how come is it that there is the president of the United States is an Afro-American, and we don't have the same thing in Cuba, in which most of the key positions are occupied by white people. And therefore, there was a reaction to that visit in terms of fear. Fear that, because he also met with a group of self-employed people in the private sector. Right. And he said that he would like to see these people grow. And they already immediately thought, well, this could be a threat to us, because if these people are empowered and they economically prosper, then they can become independent. Mm-hmm. And the first one that reacted to the visit, the day after Obama left Cuba, was Fidel Castro. He was still alive. He used to publish periodically some comments in all the newspapers, of course. And the title was "Our Brother Obama." Despite the title, really, it was a terrible attack, saying that this was the same imperialism, but that he was using different methods, more subtle, more subtle than before. And after that, everyone in the government was criticizing. So I think Cuba lost a phenomenal opportunity, because if they would have responded, not on the pressure, but as a gesture, answering all the steps, positive steps that Obama took, and do a few things that could show the United States and the world that as Pope John Paul asked to Cuba to open to the world, and the world to open to Cuba. They didn't do that. And that, in my view, was a lost opportunity. Because it actually gave munitions to everybody that is in favor of maintaining the embargo to say, you see what happened? Obama opened the relationship with Cuba, made all these concessions, and the Cuban government didn't do anything.
So, back to my question. So, what you're saying is the Cubans missed an opportunity. Now the U.S. seems to be backing off of the Obama position, saying, we're not ready to go, you know, into full diplomatic relations. We will instill some travel bans, some investments, some business bans. What does that mean then, when both parties seem to be going back?
Well, I think we have to differentiate between President Trump's rhetoric and what he have done in practice. In his speech, he said that he was going to annul all the measures taken by Obama, which seems to be a constant in his administration. Not only this, Obamacare, whatever. But then in practice, he only mentioned, he didn't mention that specifically, but in the briefing that was given to the public, he mentioned two specific things. There are 12 categories of travel to Cuba, and the most popular and easiest is the one people to people, which is a kind of a cultural exchange. And any American could say, I want to go to Cuba, and I want to see, talk with the people, I go to the museums, and listen to the music, and drink the rum, whatever. So he said that category was going to change, because you couldn't do that alone anymore, but you have to go in a group that was regulated with somebody that will be controlling that the rules are applied. And the second measure is to avoid that American tourists go to military operated hotels, restaurants, and other facilities. Of course, the government has most of the facilities, but the point is that how the Cubans are going to react to that, because it looks like he's doing the same thing that Obama did in the sense of let's support the private sector. But the difference with Obama is that he's excluding the possibility that any American tourist could go right. to the most, you know, the biggest hotels, which are, of course, operated by the government or by a subsidiary that the government gives, like a franchise. Mm-hmm. Now, the regulations have not been published yet. Apparently, right. they will be in September. So we don't know. Everything seems is the same.
But
no,
the business,
so far, it's the same.
But the business community, who was so quick to take advantage of the Obama change in policy and was willing to make investments, and I'm thinking of Starwood Hotels and Resorts, the big hotel company, and Google and Airbnb, they were all very public in their interest in investing in Cuba. They seem to be feeling really nervous about this change of policy. Where does that stand in terms of investment? Has that all been stalled?
Well, you are right in what you are saying, but you have to, you know, have to look at the other point, the other side, and really, there is a special zone in the port of Mariel. It's an economic zone that was financed by $800 million investment by Obradesh, the company in Brazil,
right.
which is in trouble.
Big trouble.
But that was a big hope for the future. And as maybe about 2 weeks ago, there were about 400 proposals of investment, and only 21 have been approved by the government. And this Mariel zone has been in operation for 3 years now. The Minister of Foreign Economic Relations have said that Cuba needs annually $2.5 billion in order to have a rate of economic growth which is needed for the country, but they are going so slow on this. The only investment that was announced by the United States was, I don't know whether you remember, it was a factory of tractors, and eventually it was never approved. So yeah, there is a great interest both in the United States and in Europe, but the Cuban government again is mm-hmm. responding right. in a very slow right. fashion, which is, I think, counterproductive in terms of the needs that they have for right. foreign investment.
And that brings me back to the book that you just published, which I want to go to in a minute. But before we go into that, which is a very interesting, fascinating topic that you're writing about, Cuba clearly doesn't only have or is only concerned about their relationship with the U.S. Cuba has had a very, very strong relationship with Venezuela for the last decades. And I would say also with Brazil. But my question for you would be, how does the huge financial crisis, or the huge crisis, political, humanitarian crisis in Venezuela affect Cuba?
Very much so. I made an estimate a few years ago in which I showed that the economy of Cuba, the whole gross domestic product, which is a way to measure the economic size, was dependent on Venezuela by 10%. That's a big chunk. And Cuba was dependent on the Soviet Union for many years, 30 years, and then there was a severe crisis, and then in 2001, the dependency on Venezuela began. And its major supply of oil is investing in the island. It's buying professional Cuban services like physicians and nurses, and we are talking about at the peak, about $11 billion. And the risk of losing that is tremendous because of what is happening, the crisis in Venezuela. And therefore, they have already cut trade. Compared with 2014, last year, there was a decline of 70% of the trade with Venezuela, including, of course, oil.
70.
Wow. And that means that they have reduced oil supply, they have cut all kind of investments. They are buying less professional services. And of course, this is true of Brazil. That was the second right. buyer of services for health services from Cuba. So it's a very serious problem. I don't think it will reach the magnitude of the 1990s crisis after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the socialist bloc. But certainly will be a very serious crisis. And of course, the Cuban population today have gone through a lot of problems. It's not the same as in the 1990s. There is more. This continues to be an authoritarian regime. But when you compare with 1993, there are much more open avenues for discussion. People are more open in the streets. I was there with my family at the beginning of the year for a week, and the people are completely disenchanted. They don't have that revolutionary spirit that they have in the 1990s. Of course, Fidel is gone. Raul is not the same as Fidel.
Right.
Therefore.
And also, Raul has already stated that he will be stepping down in February of next year.
Yes. Well, according to the law, the first vice president, who is a civilian, he's in his 50s. He's a new generation of Cubans that were not in the fighting mm-hmm. Batista, the dictator. So he's supposed to be the president following Raúl Castro's promise that he will be retiring in February of next year. But we don't know yet. We have to see whether that happens. In any case, if Raul retires from the presidency, he's going to continue, I am sure, to be the first secretary of the Communist Party, which is really, there are two major forces in Cuba. One is the party, and probably the most important one is the army, and the armed forces. And he will retain probably that position of commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And those are the two real
key positions. That's right.
A key factors in Cuba in terms of power.
Right. But you were starting to state how things are beginning to change, how a younger population is not really, into this whole, ideology or kind of myth of the party, and how things are changing in general. And that brings me to the book that you just published. And I want to say the name in English. It hasn't been published in English yet.
It's coming by the University of Pittsburgh Press in the fall.
In English.
In English.
It's called Voices of Change in the Non-State Cuban Sector. Tell us about what that book is about.
Well, this began because Raúl Castro, he took over his brother Fidel because he was sick in the summer of 2006. And then in 2007, he began to introduce what he called structural economic reforms. And one of these reforms, in my opinion, the most important one, was to allow people outside of the state to do certain activities. They are very reduced. For instance, there are 200 activities as self-employed. That are authorized. But, most of them are on skill. For instance, clowns in the street, people taking care of baths for a few pennies, mimes. There are
music. People is musicians.
Yeah, musicians. Okay. There are very few which are really skilled. For instance, real estate agents, insurance agents, translators, accountants. But the most of them are on a scale. And the most popular ones are owners of homes or like bed and breakfast, small restaurants which in Cuba are called paladares. Mm-hmm. And these people are growing very fast. Putting together these self-employed private micro-businesses and also cooperatives that were authorized by the government, and some kind of arrangement in the countryside, which is a kind of a mix between state and private, we are talking about 30% of the labor force. So we are talking about one third.
However, which is a spike.
Which is growing.
Which is growing, right.
However, their contribution to the economy is very small. Exactly. It's only 5%, mm-hmm. Much smaller than their size in the labor force, because of their skills are very low. Most of them, for instance, all professionals who are graduates from university are banned to perform their own profession. So a physician cannot practice privately as a physician. On the other hand, he or she can drive a taxi or have a small paladar. What happened is that you are losing a phenomenal investment, like, in which Cuba is very good. I mean, the Cuban population is probably the most educated population in Latin America. But at the same time, this investment is lost because these people are moving away from the state sector because they receive a very low salary. We are talking about an average of $30 a month.
For a doctor? For a physician?
For a physician. This is the average. A physician make about $50. But still, this is very low. And therefore, they leave the state sector after all the investment that the government have done for their education. And they go to, drive a taxi because they are earning high currency there.
Right, right. Dollars,
They organize a cafeteria or a small restaurant.
So, like you just said, this may not be still very important in terms of economic impact, but the numbers are growing, and this is, I'm sure, generating a shift in expectations, especially in the younger generations.
There is a phenomenal potential for this group, and that's why we decided, in cooperation with two Cuban social scientists who reside in Cuba, we didn't do a survey because you need to request permission from the government. That was out of the question. So they undertook a risky operation because we decided to do 100 interviews in Cuba. These were intensive, long interviews. Each one took anywhere between 1.5 and 2 hours. And this was, of course, anonymous. And we didn't give multiple options in terms of answers or alternative answers, as is usually done in this case. But we asked the question, allowed the interviewee to say whatever they wanted. That's why we call it Voices of Change in Cuba, because this you can hear in the book the Cubans talking to you. Uh-huh. And this is phenomenal. For instance, we found out that in spite of all the restrictions and inspections and regulations and taxes that they have, 97% said that they were having a profit. We were stunned. We couldn't believe it.
And they wouldn't say that publicly if they had to put their name. So those were profits that they're hiding in a way.
Yeah, but the government knows what they are doing because they have to pay taxes. Of course, they own the report.
Right.
What they are doing, and now the government is trying to regulate that because they...
Good luck with that.
because they want to get more money from taxes. Right. But one of the very interesting things is that successful micro entrepreneurs in Cuba will tell you that they don't want to be very visible. Because if they show their opulence, and some of them are making a lot of money. I mean, people who are renting, we rented a big mansion in Havana. And we pay, we were nine, the whole family, including their children. And we pay more than $5,000 for 1 week. Yeah, but if you were go to a state hotel, it would have paid much more. Actually, it was 40% the cost of a hotel for the nine of us.
Interesting.
And it was excellent. Employees were fantastic. Service, breakfast was great. It's the only thing that we ate there was tropical fruits and juices and eggs in different ways and bread. Mm-hmm. So very, very good because they have an incentive.
And these are mostly younger people?
Most people are very
daring.
Young. The average is 41 years old. And Cuba has the oldest population in Latin America. And this process of aging is increasing very fast. So we are talking about young people, and mostly whites. Mm-hmm. A relatively small proportion of Afro-Cubans.
Urban, in Havana. Mostly in Havana.
Urban. This group is, we interview another group, which is they are farmers, small farmers. But I think the most interesting group is this one. We are talking about 12% of the labor force are these private self-employed people with a small, tiny business.
So do you foresee this group of small, yet very, very small entrepreneurs to grow and have an impact in the political system and the demand from the public, from the government? I mean, how they will present themselves as a group with demands to the government?
Unfortunately, and I mentioned this earlier when I said that Obama created scare in the Cuban leadership because of the potential threat of this group. In the last few weeks, the Cuban government is dictating a series of regulations and decree laws that will restrict this factor. For instance, they said we are not going to grant more licenses to certain activities. Other activities are under inspection. For instance, the cooperative have been an experiment for 5 years now, and they said the experiment have to continue because we have found deviations. This is a word that they use. They are doing things that are not according to law, and we are going to enforce the law. So there is a big question mark whether this group, which is so vital for the future economy of Cuba, is going to continue growing because of this government fear, concern that they may become very powerful economically, and then if they do so, then they could have also political influence, which would be against the Cuban government interests.
But I'm also wondering is, I mean, Raúl will not be around forever, and his successor, if it is the person expected, the
Miguel Díaz-Canel.
Exacto. He's in his 50s. He's a younger leader. Venezuela is in a terrible crisis, will not be able to step up and help the financial situation that would probably ensue out of that lack of trade. Cuba will find itself in a way kind of alone without the U.S., without Cuba, Russia.
Yeah,
is
right.
So you know, how much can they push back on
this
new generation?
I mean, I have been thinking about this, and I have a very good relationship with academic Cuban, academic economist, and we think more or less alike. And we cannot understand because we are saying Cuba is in this very difficult position, and therefore the only alternative that they have is to open up to the non-state sector. It has shown that they have the capacity to turn around the economy, and yet they are imposing restrictions to it. It's like a suicide.
Right, right.
And, you know, I am always puzzled because you cannot expect logical economics in Cuba. The political logic is predominant over the economic logic.
But you can always expect great music and great food.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Professor, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Hope you will come back again and share more about your book.
Thank you for inviting me.
We've been talking to Professor Carmelo Mesa Lago from the University of Pittsburgh about Cuba's current realities. Thank you all for listening in. Thank you, Amy, our producer. We'll be back with you next week.
Thank you for listening to the World Affairs Report, brought to you by the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh in cooperation with KQV News Radio. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that has been bringing the world to Pittsburgh for over 80 years. To learn more about the council and upcoming events, please visit worldpittsburgh.org. Be with us again next week when we take a 30-minute look at issues of global importance.